Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is Monday, the 20th of February, 2012, and that must mean nothing other than the international forecaster Bob Chapman himself is gracing us with his presence for yet another week. So, Bob Chapman, always great to have you on. Thanks again for your time.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you here, as always. So let's start going over some of the interesting news that's been developing recently, including an article that is hot off the press, just came out earlier today from Bloomberg, and it says Iceland raised to investment grade at Fitch on recovery. Quote, Iceland was raised to investment grade at Fitch ratings after the island pushed through measures that helped stabilize its financial markets and revive growth following the economic collapse of 2008. The island's long-term issuer default rating was raised to BBB- from BB+, Fitch said it in a statement today, and the outlook is stable, it said. So, Bob, is this actually a good news story about a country that actually managed to put one over on the banksters, or is there something else going on here?
No, I think it's good for one side and bad for the other. The bankers are being shown that they're not as all-powerful as they think they are. And what's happened here is that Iceland has gone back to we'll call it a conservative economic and financial approach, and they didn't allow themselves to be sucked into the vortex created by banks which were privately owned that caused all the problems in the first place. And the very fact that the British and Netherlands governments would ask the public to, I guess we call it, insure or make good the depositors of those banks is absurd. I've never heard or known of that happening in history before. And so with that said, I think they did the absolute right thing, and it's turning out that way.
Well, actually, yeah, it says the economy of Iceland, which exited a 33-month International Monetary Fund program in August, will grow faster than the euro area average this year and next after the island's authorities spurred household demand by backing debt relief programs. So it really does look like they've really stuck it to the banksters in every possible way, including exiting that IMF fund program. So that does seem positive. And does that present a possible way out for other European economies that are struggling right now?
Well, I think the debt picture was different there. They had personal bank debt that had to be contended with, that had to be written off. You have that in the other European nations, which have similar problems today. But you have a mountainous amount of governmental debt in those countries that are in trouble today. And so it's different. It's not the same. Is the debt rightly owned? The answer is yes. The governments took it along on with the bankers. And can they pay it? No. The smaller ones, the three that come to mind, Greece, Ireland, and Portugal, can never pay it. In the case of Ireland, the politicians should have never accepted the debt of banks. Totally unheard of. Totally unheard of. And so, no, the situations, I think, is much different. And I think those nations in that position should default and go back to their own currencies. And as far as the economies in Belgium, they'll get subsidized because it's a small country. And as you know, Brussels is the home of the one world government. And so I don't think they're going to let that go down, even though the country's a mess culturally as well as politically because of the balkanization that's taken place over the years. And so I think Italy and Spain will be saved because they want to keep them in that group, at least at this time. And I'll tell you why I say that in a minute. And so what I see happening is the attempt to, you might call it, keeping Spain and Italy in business. The problem is they're looking at $4 trillion. And even if they gave that money to those two countries, it wouldn't make the debt go away. All it would do would change the structure of the debt. And it would still have to be paid. And so eventually the problem becomes manifest and they can't do anything about it. And that's really where they are now, and they're getting extended by this money that's being lent by the Federal Reserve to the European Central Bank. And it's not a currency swap, it's a loan, which is illegal. And they expect to buy a year and a half or two by having that money. And once they've squandered that, what do they do next? Probably give them another $1.6 trillion. And they're going to do that until they can't do it anymore. And that's going to affect, you know, we're seeing some deflation in Switzerland because of the strength of its currency. But if Europe comes out even this year, GDP-wise, or goes to plus 1.5% or 2%, which is possible, then the deflation in Switzerland will stop temporarily, and the pressure on their franc will be relieved temporarily. But Swiss has a long-term problem. They're successful. And sometimes innocent parties get stomped upon in situations like this. And what can they do? Well, they can continue to try to keep the franc from appreciating, and probably one of the good ways to do that is to tax the use of the French, Swiss franc. And that's something that nobody's brought up as yet that they did during the 1970s. I know I was there. So I think that the situation in Europe is a complex one. And what I was referring to before is, does Germany really want to stay in the euro? I mean, we have so many conflicting stories now. We don't know who's telling the truth. It's a hard call, let me tell you.
Well, let's back up a minute, because you mentioned in the oxymoronically named sovereign debt crisis in Europe that that the debt is rightly owed and that the politicians did sign their countries on to pay the banksters these various debts. So a lot of people would argue that these are, in fact, odious debts, that they were created in backroom deals with unaccountable politicians and banksters, and would argue that the theory of odious debt applies here. What's your take on that, and where do you think odious debt would apply here, or in Iceland, or in some other context, or where can we fit that that idea in?
Well, I think what one has to do is come to terms with what the problem is. And they're never going to do that until they're forced to, they being the people who run Europe. And they want world government, and this is part of their setup, and that hasn't worked. That would be the euro and the European Union. And I think Germany recognizes that. And I think they're saying, maybe saying, that, hey, this is it. We're tired of subsidizing everybody else. We've paid for our sins of World War II. We want all these troops out of here. We want our culture back. And we want our D-mark back. Now, I know that Germany's going to be in the same spot that Switzerland is right now, as a successful country. And they're going to have to fight very hard to continue to export. because AD Mark, that would be strong, just like the Swiss franc is something they'll have to come, surmount. And as I said before, there's two sides of this thing. And even though Germany and Switzerland have done nothing wrong, they've been very successful. So I think after all of the delays we saw last week and all of the rhetoric and all of the fences that have been set up to deter Greek success in staying within the Eurozone would tell me there's at least a faction, and maybe the whole group in Germany, that wants Greece out, the other two out, and I think they want it to break up so they can be king of the heap.
Well, that does seem to be sort of a strategy that we've become all too familiar with, the failing forward of basically breaking things up in order to rule over the pieces that are left on the table. And some indication of that comes from a BBC article that just came out about Greek bailout elements in place, says Francis Barouin. And so it says some Eurozone ministers doubt Greece's austerity pledges. Well, there you go. So once again, we're having this bailout talk dangled before us as if this is going to be somehow the solution to this crisis. And again, it seems like shuffling deck chairs on a Titanic to me. And perhaps, as you say, this is part of a plan for Germany to really either gain more control or perhaps to just get Greece out of the picture altogether.
Well, I spoke about this a few months ago, and I said I didn't have the answer because I wasn't behind the scenes. And I don't have anybody there, in this instance at least. So this is really what they were up to. They're looking at the poll numbers, too. 65% of Germans now, and when the Euro and the European Unions were respectively formed 25 years ago, and then 10 years ago, they did not want to be in that currency union or European Union. In fact, among females, the figures were 72%. Males, it was 68% as far as the euro was concerned. I think they've always wanted to go on their own. They don't feel they need anybody else. And, of course, the clarion cry comes from all of these one-worlders. Well, if Germany is not attached to this union through currencies or otherwise, they're going to go and they're going to go attack people again and kill them. And that's not true. We've had two generations since the Second World War. And people are different today. And the last thing in the world the average person wants is war. The only people that want war is the Illuminati, so they can make more money and control people and cover up the destruction of the financial system.
Very true, but as we all know, unfortunately, they always have the ability to try to steer public opinion towards war, as we've found, of course, many, many times throughout history, and was revealed most famously in the testimony of Norman Dodd, who was talking about how he had access to the Carnegie Foundation's meeting minutes from its inception in 1908, where he was talking about how they had debated in a most learned fashion how best to steer society, and having determined after about a year's worth of debates that war was the best way in shaping a society, they determined how to get America embroiled in a war. And as he put it quite memorably in what should be a very famous interview with G. Edward Griffin, he said that nothing could have been further from the mind of the average American during that time than the prospect of being embroiled in another giant war. And lo and behold, a few years later, World War I broke out, and America became involved, of course. So unfortunately, there's always the possibility of steering the public back towards war as its main method of control, and of course also making money on the side, as you point out. That's always a great way to fund the very operations that can contribute to the failure of the society that they want to see destroyed.
You know, I have a copy of a book that was done in research by the Carnegie Foundation. And it was published in 1962-63. And it was to solve the South African crisis through invasion. I mean, these people have been warmongers for a long, long time. Just to let those know that this is not a isolated case of trying to get into war. And I happen to have a copy of that. I'm probably one of the few people in the world who do. And in those days, you can get them because they didn't figure anybody knew anything about anything. Well, obviously I did, along with G. Edward Griffin. And I think that it just goes to show you in spades what these foundations are up to. They fund them. The profits, for the most part, go into starting wars. But if you asked Americans or the whole world, there wouldn't be 0.01% that would know that. And these are the things that tend to give you a basis for further decisions, because you can reflect back and say, well, you know, these guys did this before. They're up to it again. So it's something to think about, because it's a good way to base future decisions on what these people have done in the past.
Well, as a side note, I would say that absolutely, we live in a digital age, so you should look into digitizing not only that book, but any other books in your collection that you think might be important, because certainly we live in an age where it's still at least possible for the time being to spread this information quite far and wide. So at any rate, let's return to something that you mentioned earlier, talking about countries going back to their own currency as the possible way out of this. And I'll mention an editorial by Ambrose Evans Pritchard in The Telegraph that came out this weekend, "Can a Return to the Drachma Save Greece as Unemployment Soars?" Talking about, of course, the Greek situation, but as is mentioned, the possibility of a return to the drachma is one of the saving graces. So now this is being discussed more openly than it has been in the past, and we're at least seeing the beginnings of the debate, or at least the beginnings of the debate in the mainstream media. Bob, tell people why this is really the way out, and why Greece should be returning to the drachma.
Okay, what has transpired over many years, and particularly the last 8 years for Greece, is they created a mountain of debt. And there's no way out. Now, no matter what road they take, it's going to be dreadful, and you're already seeing that. So what do you do next? Well, you can't stay in, although you might like to, the Eurozone, because the currency is too expensive. You can't compete with other nations, especially those you habitually, historically have traded with: Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco, and Turkey in particular. And of course, they don't like each other anyway, and never have. And so you have a situation where if you stay, or allowed to stay, in the Eurozone, it's going to be a continuum of problems. I mean, they can't devalue because they have no control. And so they're trapped. It's like a giant being trapped in a baby's body. And so they've got to get out. And the only rational way to do that is default on everything, both personal debt, with other countries, as well as governmental debt. And if they do that, they will have a depression, which they're already in, the next 5 or 10 years, and it'll be awful. But the other way is even worse, because they keep on giving you loans, you keep on trying to survive, and you can't, and it gets worse. Only you're paying all this money back. Do you know that what the European Commission did? They said that any of the monies that come in from loans from other European nations to keep them afloat goes into a special account, and they can't touch it. It's got to go to the banks. Ain't nobody ever told you that. They use a double negative. But that's the way it is. So it's not helping the economy one bit. They're still strangling and struggling and staggering on their own. And how long will this debt last? Maybe 50, 100 years? I mean, do you really want to be saddled with that? You know, Greece got along fine before the euro came. They'll get along fine again. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be terrible. Look at it now. 50% of small businesses are out of business. 20% of shops in Athens are closed. People are leaving the country to live with relatives in other countries because they can't even feed themselves. Suicides have gone berserk. I mean, they're not doing the right thing. They being PASOK, which is a party in power, which is a far-left party. And there's an election coming in April. And the middle-of-the-road conservative party of Mr. Samaras, New Democratic Party, they will be elected. And they're going to say, look, I don't care how many agreements you made, we're not going to stand up to them. We're not paying that money back, because those banks should have never lent that money in the first place. And all these politicians get paid off. And then he's going after all the politicians since 1974, which ought to be very interesting, which includes Papandreou's father, Andras, who was reputed to be the worst criminal politician in the history of Greece. And that goes back 3,500, 4,000 years. And of course, he was a communist, although that meant nothing, and that was just a way of getting into office. And so, as I said 2.5 years ago on Greek radio and television, editorials, default, go back to the drachma, clean up your mess, and live happily ever after.
Well, exactly right. In fact, that's a point that that Evans Pritchard did made in his editorial, where he's talking about the political ramifications of Greece, and basically desperate times call for desperate measures. And he writes, the indignados in Syntagma Square replay with mocking cruelty the immortal speech of PASOK leader George Papandreou, gushing that there is enough money for everything. Voter sympathy is splintering to the hard left and hard right. The latest bestseller in Greece is the Greek translation of Heinrich Winkler's Weimar 1918 to 1933 History of the First German Democracy, narrating how an indebted Germany pursued the same deflation policies under the gold standard as Greece is now pursuing under EMU, with the same results. The book culminates in the Reichstag elections of July 1932, when the Nazis and communists between them won half the seats and Weimar died. Such parallels are always inexact. The radical parties of Syriza and the democratic left are not authoritarian, yet their ascendancy surely threatens to shatter the existing order. So, of course, raising the specter, which I think probably lies heavier on the European countries in general, and especially when Germany is threatening, of renewed, if not Nazism, at least some sort of radical politics that will destabilize the euro and the European Union in general. So, of course, that's always a part of that political calculus. So just before leaving this very interesting events that are taking shape in Europe, perhaps you can comment on the possibility that that unfortunately people will once again be steered into false political solutions by some charismatic leader that might come along at this opportune time.
I don't think that's going to happen in Greece. The appointment of Papademos was a very, very bad mistake. Here is an appointed president. I mean, who has ever heard of such a thing in a democracy? And why? Because he's an Illuminist. He's a longtime member of the Trilateral Commission. He's a Bilderberger. And this guy's bad news for the people. You know, good news for the bankers. And the people have learned that, you know, this guy couldn't do what he was supposed to do. And I think it's because the New Democratic Party held its frontal line. They wouldn't buckle. Sure, they voted for the new second bailout. But when Germany asked them to personally sign that they wouldn't change it, they said, no, we're not going to do that. And incidentally, the far left only has 5% of the vote now. What will they get in the future? Maybe 20. And that and the votes that the New Democratic Party will get will run the country. And rightly so. And I'm optimistic on that note. It might seem like Weimar, but it isn't. And the difference is there's not a Reichsmark or a drachma. There's a euro instead. So they can't do that. But maybe the outcome could be that way, but I don't think so. I don't think people like Samaras, who incidentally is no dummy, he graduated from Harvard, and he is going to want to go down in the history books as the guy that saved Greece from itself. And I think he could do it. And so they're just waiting for the election. And Germany's frustrated because they're not getting what they want. And but I think behind the scenes, Germany wants to go it alone. And I think they should. I mean, there's business of unions. If you want to set up deals from country to country, that's fine. Particularly on tariffs and things like that. But this bureaucratic nightmare that is the European Union today, Mike, you know, these guys get paid $500,000 a year and all they do is poke around all day. Who is that Brit who speaks so eloquently about these situations, who's in the European Parliament?
Would that be Nigel Farage, the leader of the United Kingdom Independence Party?
I mean, he just lays it to them. And those dummies just sit there and don't say anything. No challenge. All they want is $500,000 a year and a pension. That's all it's all. And they all take orders from the same group of people, just like our politicians do in America and many other countries as well.
Sad but true, isn't it? Well, okay, let's turn our attention eastward to a different part of the globe right now. And of course, I refer to China and China's glowing economic clout and yet its own internal problems with inflation and other such things. So let's take a look at a very interesting article that popped up on StratRisks.com recently. China's War Chest, China Sets Up Fund to Bankroll Takeovers. And this sources to Deutsche Welle. Boasting $3.2 trillion in foreign currency reserves, China has created a new fund aimed at financing takeover bids abroad. The fund also seeks to boost China's currency in global financial markets. In its drive to step up overseas investment, the Chinese government has set up a new fund worth 12 billion yuan, which is $1.9 billion, Shanghai International Group said in a statement Friday. Shanghai International said it was responsible for running the fund, describing it as China's biggest ever fund of its kind. The yuan-backed fund will help domestic companies go abroad in seeking more investment opportunities, China's central bank deputy governor Liu Xiu was quoted by the official Shanghai Daily newspaper as saying. So, Bob, what's behind this, and is this something to be concerned about? Is this something that is to be expected? Is this something that will have any appreciable effect in the near future?
What took them so long? It's just like the accumulation of gold with excess currency, whether it's a yuan or the internal currency, which is the, what's the name for that one? Can't think of it. Offshore profits. 3.1 trillion was the figure. They got to get rid of it. It's a natural course of events that they should go out and buy everything that's a decent price and get rid of these currencies. And then they'll get more income from that invested funds instead of keeping it in U.S. Treasuries at 0.25%. I mean, when inflation in the dollar is running 10 or 11%. So that's pretty simple. And they should have started doing that about 10 years ago. But they wanted to be, I think, Mr. Nice Guy. They appreciated the opportunity. They got 1995, and they wanted to take advantage of it. But on the other hand, they wanted to show their appreciation. Now, what is the flip side of that? That means the yuan is going to get much stronger. And that's going to block their ability to continue to make the kind of profits that they have in the past. And that is a problem for them. But, you know, there's an end to how much you can make, too. And they have a tremendous advantage, slave labor. And other countries have that, too, but evidently their slave labor is more organized than the other fellows are. But that's also going to push up the standard of living. It's going to push up wages internally. And it's going to put pressure on creating money when they shouldn't be, like you just did with the real estate boom, to keep the economy going. But China still has 30 million unemployed. You know, what are they doing them? I mean, the best thing they could possibly have is probably a war. They can get rid of 30 million people. I know that's crass, but, you know, governments think in those terms. I mean, just look at the United States government. One war after another. I think the War of 1812 was probably the only one that they didn't plan. The British planned that when they wanted to take America back. So I think China will do okay. Their growth is going to drop to about 7% this year. That's all right. They're in the same category as India. And I think they'll continue to do okay. They're going to suffer financially with everybody else because of what's going on in Europe and England, the United States, only half as much. Just like Canada and Mexico and Australia and other countries. And so China's going to have a harder road. But it's, you know, they had a joyride. And what happens if somehow, eventually, we have tariffs on goods and services in the United States? It's a good question. That's going to make China's job even harder.
Indeed. Well, going to blacklistednews.com, we have the specter of currency wars when we talk about China. And it's this is a story that sources to mina.fn.com. And it's talking about China's central bank has just lowered its bank reserve requirement. It says the People's Bank of China said it will cut back bank reserve ratio in a move to boost the slowing economic growth. The central bank will lower reserve requirement ratio for major commercial banks to 20.5% from 21%. and the cut will free tens of billions of dollars for lending at a time when the growth rate is expected to drop from last quarter's 8.9% to closer to 8%. So the red-hot Chinese economy showing some signs of slowing down a little bit, and then we see this as a move to try to boost growth again. Do you think there is, a serious currency war going on right now with the yuan, or is this being hyped up a little?
No. No, I really don't. I mean, you always have currency problems. Either one way or the other. It's like today with the euro and the Swiss franc. I mean, the Swiss franc's getting killed because it's successful. The euro, on the other hand, is lower because they're unsuccessful. And if you're in the trading world, that's something you got to live with. You know, there's no free lunches out there. And so there is a spectrum that we have to look at in bringing balance to the system. And that's what they tried to do in Europe. And they were totally unsuccessful. And that's because that southern tier, which is culturally different, we'll put it that way, doesn't want to and can't compete with the North that likes to work. It's pretty simple. So you can't take and apply the same standard to 27 different countries. It's impossible. And the world's finding that out. So you got to keep it in balance if you can. You see the deal that's being made for oil by India presently. 45% is the latest word in rupee, and that's their currency, for those who didn't know. And maybe that's the wrong pronunciation. I don't have the local derivation on that one. The rest of it's going to be in trade. Iran has agreed to buy things from India for 55%, evening the trade out. Now that accomplishes a whole bunch of things. Balance, cuts out the use of the dollar, and it accommodates India, which would have to probably use its gold otherwise to get oil. And that can't last too long because part of the structure of India is its vast gold holdings. So maybe we're looking at a model for the future where a country will take China. Instead of having the momentous success that they've had, have a marginal success because of bringing balance to the system and foregoing profits in order to keep the system from collapsing. We may be looking at a whole new world in international trade and finance.
A new world order?
No. A different way of approaching things being forced upon people, particularly countries that are eminently successful, which would be China. I mean, just think of it for a moment. China's doing the same thing Germany is. Now, the structure's different, but the result is the same.
Well, you raise the specter of the world's other hotspot and how it's attempting to deal with its increasing isolation. So let's switch our focus a little bit to Tehran. And of course, we've just gotten the word from the AP and other outlets that UN nuke inspectors are leaving for key talks in Tehran, as apparently there's been some high-level diplomatic pressure from Moscow and Beijing for Iran to come back to some sort of bargaining table, I guess, with the IAEA, although for what purpose, I can't really understand. But as perhaps as response or perhaps something else, we also get this report pretty much simultaneously from Reuters. Iran stops oil sales to British and French firms. Iran has stopped selling crude to British and French companies, the oil ministry said on Sunday, in a retaliatory measure against fresh EU sanctions on the Islamic State's lifeblood, oil. Exporting crude to British and French companies has been stopped. We will sell our oil to new customers, spokesman Alreza Nikzad was quoted as saying by the Ministry of Petroleum website. The European Union in January decided to stop importing crude from Iran from July 1st over its disputed nuclear program, which the West says is aimed at building bombs. Iran denies this. So we have this supposed retaliation. I'm not sure how much of this is just smoke and mirrors, as there was the embargo anyway, but anyways, they've cut off this spigot early. Is this going to have any appreciable effect on relations, or is this just Iran trying to play whatever card it has up its sleeve?
Oh, I think it'll have dramatic, absolutely dramatic results. They talked about this 2 weeks ago, and I didn't have anything finite on it. A report came out, but it was not for general distribution, from Tehran, stating just this sort of thing. They thought that Holland and France would be, quote, the victims, instead of waiting till July 1st, that Tehran was going to say, forget it, we're going to do it now. Well, I didn't see that release that just came out yesterday. And that is, you know, you want to play hardball, let's do it. And now Britain's got a problem. I don't know how much oil, if any at all, that they get from Tehran. But the fact that England, along with the United States, created economic warfare on the country, it's sort of tit for tat. You pull that on us, we're going to pull this on you. And you're going to see more of that. Don't forget, Tehran has China and Russia behind them. Very, very close treaties. And that's why I said 2.5 months ago, when they were parading all these ships in and out of the straits and all this garbage, it was phony baloney. It was an act, a very expensive one, incidentally, to keep those ships going in there. And then they guaranteed, the U.S. did, the cost of all of that to the American taxpayer. A game. They were playing a game. Nobody else came out and said that because they couldn't figure it out. I mean, headlines all over the world. War is imminent. What war? I mean, what planet are they on? And so, I think this is really about the petrodollar. Everybody knows there's no nuclear devices involved. The British and the United States have lost credibility and confidence, and they will continue to do so. The dollar, because of it, is going to decline in value versus other currencies, never mind gold and silver. And they've made a terrible mistake. Terrible. They shot themselves in both feet. I mean, how hard do you think it is to go around SWIFT code? You have to be kidding me. All I have to do, let's say, Tehran has $1 billion in rupees from India. And they can't go through SWIFT code to transfer those to India or anybody else. So they give them to the Russians. The Russians take a fee. And the Russians sell them to somebody else. I mean, this thing is so poorly thought out. I mean, these people in the State Department, they live in a different world. And it's not that they're stupid, you know, they're not. One of the guys that was in counterintelligence with me was one of the top people in the State Department. He was my roommate. And so all I can think of is they have some kind of another agenda that I don't know about, and neither does anybody else. But on the face of it, that's a mess. And the dollar's got to pay for it. And you have one Middle Eastern nation break and start buying, selling oil in any currency other than the dollar. It's over for the dollar. That's what's holding it together. We'll protect you. I believe, and buy your oil. But we've got to manage the money. And you've got to only deal in dollars. That was the deal. 1971. Just like the deal they made in the 1920s with those wild Arabs running the desert there. I mean, these guys are no more than kings and princes than howdy-doody. I mean, they're just a bunch of robbers. But, you know, that fits the part.
Well, as you point out, and I think it is important to do so, the Britain and France and the U.S. and all of these other thugs of the NATO Imperial Army that have relied on the petrodollar hegemony for so long certainly have lost so much, or assuming they really had any to begin with, but have lost so much not only confidence and respect in the eyes of the public, but I think just fundamentally, the all of their insane actions have really discredited themselves for themselves. But of course, we wouldn't ever learn that from watching the propaganda media that only ever serves to prop up the establishment. It only comes through an understanding derived from the alternative media. And of course, the International Forecaster being one of the dominant newsletters out there that's been talking about this for decades now. So tell people again about the Forecaster and how they can get their own copy of it.
Well, the International Forecaster is about business, finance, economic, social, and political issues all over the world. We publish by email on Wednesday and Saturday, runs around 35 or 40 pages each time. And we have a hard copy that goes out twice a month for those who are not on the Internet. Everything that you need to know each week is in that publication. You can get a free introductory copy by going to the internationalforecaster.com, the international forecaster.com. You can also go to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who want to ask a question, we answer everyone. Get a report, or get a report on our latest releases on gold and silver shares. Use our email address, Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com, Bob at intforecaster.com. And for those of you who would like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178. 877-479-8178. You can get the copies there. And for those of you who want to become subscribers, that's a good place to go to. And the reason why is I have an offer there, a free one-year subscription. You should take advantage of it. The offer is really terrific.
I certainly hope that people will do so, and I certainly hope that many of them already have. But at any rate, Bob Chapman, always great, so I'm looking forward to more of your analysis in the future. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, and thank you all for listening.